20 laps it is then. Race number one here at the Pirelli Tyre Round. Building up to what could be a quartet of victories for Alvaro Bautista. The pace has been similar for Jonathan Rea though on the race tyre. Can he make it last for 20 laps? We are underway.
Hello and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 595. I'm back again, one of your hosts, Skyler Vicroy. And on this show, we're going to be talking World Superbike from Thailand and Daytona 200, kind of, a little bit. But to do that, joining me today is Derek Cabrera. Derek, how's it going, man?
It is going. Spring is finally arriving here in the Northeast. And yeah, I'm pumped. Motorcycles are in full swing again.
Absolutely. We set the clocks forward out here, and I feel like it's just, it turned the sun on as well. Beautiful weather we've had over the last 3 days, about 75 degrees. So I know most people that are sitting there freezing in their house are probably really hating me right about now.
Yeah, you know, it was 70 in Brooklyn the other day for one day, and now it's back to 45s. So, but even that feels like it's warm. So I'll take it.
We're getting there. So before we get into the show, we want to thank all of our donors. You guys are super cool friends of the show, and we really do appreciate it. Every little bit that you can help. Remember, if you want to be a donator, jump it over to our website. That's motopodcast.com. On the left-hand side of the page, you'll notice there's two blue donate buttons. You can just do a subscription or a one-time payment. Whatever you want to do is happy with us. We always appreciate anything that comes to the show, just so we can turn it back and give you a better show, getting out to races, interviews, etc. You guys already know this whole spiel. I'm just doing it off the top of my head. If PayPal is not your deal, we also have a Patreon site. That's patreon.com/motopod. You can head over there and do your donations as well. Whatever you want to do, a little bit, a lot, we appreciate it either way. And we just appreciate all of you. All right. So, Derek, we actually did finally get a little bit of listener feedback, although it did come back a couple rounds ago while we were talking about the World Superbike race in Australia, and it comes from our friend Gary Chavit. He goes, "Hi, guys. Just listened to the show, and I want to comment. First of all, I think it's a great idea to put the show out shorter, one-topic episodes. I have no interest in Moto America and always skip over the parts where we discuss it. BSB I only listen to if I really have extra time on my hands. Didn't anyone watch the Supersport race?" He's referring to Phillip Island, of course. "Doesn't anyone else but me have an issue with the stupid mandatory minimum length pit stop? I always love Supersport races, but this ruins it for no reason that I can see. Keep up the good work, Gary." Gary, as always, thanks for writing in. First and foremost, I think me and Derek and all of us that are editing love the shorter shows and getting more specific with certain topics and distributing the work. So thanks for writing in about that. Derek, now, I did read a bit of news on what had happened when they had to go in and make the mandatory pit stops. And this was much like MotoGP had to do back in, I think it was, what, 2013, 2014? The surface is just too abrasive.
2013. And that's surprising. I mean, Pirelli's been there for every single year with World Superbike, World Supersport. They know the surface, and it's not getting any more abrasive. So that's pretty surprising, but Pirelli itself is a soft carcass tire, and just as the super sport bikes get faster, you know, maybe they just weren't anticipating the corner speeds. I don't know, man, but it is a little surprising that Pirelli had that issue still.
Yeah, so Gary, they know they had the test there a few days prior to the race, and that's when Pirelli discovered abnormal wear from the super sport tires. And this actually happened, was it last year with the World Superbike as well? They tore up the tires and they had to do the mandatory pit stops. So Phillip Island is just super, super abrasive. Some of that, I wonder, Derek, if it comes from being so close to the water, and that since it gets a bit of weather and salt probably maybe chews up the asphalt a little bit, and so maybe it makes it a little bit less predictable from year to year.
That's interesting. Yeah, I could see that. I mean, weather conditions and motorcycle tires, like any little thing can make a massive impact. So yeah, very well could.
Well, hope that answers your question, Gary, and thank you for writing in. Remember, folks, if you want to be like our friend Gary here and write in, our email is motopod@motopodcast.com. That goes to all the hosts. One of us will answer it, quite quickly. If not, you'll get it on the show when we find out that it's something that can go ahead we want to really get into. All right, Derek, let's step into the news. So during the first race, or actually this is the Super Bowl race, ended up being shortened, there was an incident towards the back of the field that involved Tittipon Werikon, Leon Kamier, and I think there was one more rider who actually Werikon was involved in. And it was Teddy Mercado, if I'm not mistaken. But unfortunately, Werikon got the worst of the accident. He ended up going down, and it was that real scary thing that we always hate in motorcycle races. The guy behind had no place to go, and Kamier collided with Werikon while he was on the ground, which ejected Kamier, and he sustained a little bit of injury too. But Werikon needed to go to the hospital. He had a concussion. It looked like there had been some other maybe head injuries. He has some chest injuries. That kind of stuff is always super, super scary when they have to work with someone on the track like that, because a lot of internal damage can happen in the chest area, and it can be very severe quite quickly.
Yeah, and you know, hopefully he ends up being okay at the end of the day, but I think that that's one of the kind of scary things with the Super Bowl race, is that because everyone is so tight for just 10 laps, and then to add into the mix, you know, Werikon's a wild card, so obviously he wants to do really well in front of his home base. You know, he's pushing, Kamier's pushing, he wants to get the result, so everyone's close together. And like you said, you know, ultimately at the end of the day, two of them get into an accident, the one behind has nowhere to go, and that's the really scary thing about the Super Bowl race. So hopefully, as we see the Super Bowl race, you know, go throughout the season, I love it. I think it's been the two races so far have been pretty exciting, but this is a concern that I had and has already come to fruition in the second race so far. So I think it's something to look out for, but yeah, definitely a shame that kind of ruined the weekend of three riders.
Yeah, and we'll jump a little bit more back into Super Bowl. You said some interesting things there, a Super Bowl race in just a little bit. But first, British Superbike is out testing in Portimao. As of today, Scott Redding was leading on the Budweiser Ducati, followed up by Xavi Flores. Those are two new riders to the series. Scott Redding, of course, from GP, and Xavi Flores from the aforementioned World Superbike. Josh Brooks was in third, followed by Tommy Bridwell, Andrew Irvin, Terry McKenzie, Claudio Corti, Luke Massi, Jason O'Halloran, and Danny Bucknin. And anyone that's listened to BSB in the last 5 years will recognize all those names at the pointy end. It looks like it's going to be another real good season just after the first day of testing. That top 10 right there was only separated by a second. And there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 manufacturers right there. I got to say, man, BSB has definitely got it going on.
Yeah, it's looking very exciting. Definitely, after seeing how well Scott's done during the preseason, I'm bummed that I know I won't be able to follow it throughout the season. Just because there's nowhere to watch British Superbike here.
Yeah, it gets a little tough.
It definitely gets tough. But yeah, the bikes look good. The riders look good. Looks like it's going to be a close championship. The tracks are always so much fun to watch. And I think that's going to be interesting to see how Redding kind of adapts to the circuits that he doesn't know, that are, you know, like the British staples.
You know, it could be a real strong start to the Ducati V4 era with the way Bautista's going in World Superbike and Redding's already out there, you know, tearing it up and testing. You know, we got Kyle Wyman here in Moto America. I mean, no pressure, Kyle, but these guys are all winning races. We expect you to do the same, or leading testing. I mean, what else is there to do, right?
Yeah, especially with the result that he had over the weekend at Daytona.
Yeah. No, let's just knock that out first, because then we'll get into World Superbike. There's not a whole lot. I don't think I didn't get a chance to catch all the race. I think they do have it on demand on fanschoice.tv. And that, of course, ladies and gentlemen, is the Daytona 200, one of the most famous races here in America. Now, the Daytona 200, not what it used to be, of course. This is a race where all the factory teams, and since Moto America has become what it is now, they kind of pulled back from that. And to a lesser extent, to not be mean about it, it's kind of a really fancy club race, kind of.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Yeah, but you will get big names out there. For instance, Kyle Wyman, Moto America racer. Bobby Funk, Moto America racer. Josh Hayes, four-time AMA champion. Make his little comeback to racing, and he's working with his wife's team, Melissa Melissa Paris Hayes. I was trying not to get tongue-twisted, but yeah, we're off to a great start so far. Anyway, her racing team, and we had quite a few other notable names that were out there. For the most part, the race was going great up until about three laps to go, and we had a little incident down in turn one. Rider crashed, had to get a little bit of medical attention, and so they had to do a restart with, what was it, like four laps to go?
I think they just did a three-lap restart. There was the warm-up lap and then three laps. So it's kind of silly that a 200-mile endurance race comes down to a three-lap sprint. Especially the way it was going. You had Bobby Fong up front with Brandon Pash, I think. I think he raced in the KTM Cup for a little while. I don't know if he's still in Moto America or if he's over in Europe at this point, but it was between him and Bobby Fong, just because there were some issues with pit stops for the other riders, both for Wyman and for Sean Kelly, who was on the pole. Yeah, and then ultimately just ends up coming down to that three-lap sprint, which it's exciting for the fans, but it must be gut-wrenching for the riders and the teams who have put the work in to get their riders to where they are, you know?
Yeah, and one of those benefactors, of course, is Kyle Wyman, who at the time I think was running around about third or fourth, but was some distance behind Fong, and during the restart got it going and eventually pushed it around to get the win.
Yeah, he ended up getting the drive out of one of the chicanes, and he pulled a gap, and just that last lap he just pushed. So yeah, he ended up getting that win, and then it was Sean Kelly in second, and then Bobby Fong in third, which again is tough, but it's the two Moto America XR Suzuki 600s, M4 XR Suzuki 600, so all Moto America racers on the podium, all solid teams. And it was interesting. This is like the first year that I actually got to watch. I watched almost all of it. I watched the first couple laps and came back with like 20 laps to go. So it was a regular race for me, I guess. But yeah, it was interesting to see, like you said, kind of a glorified club race, but a lot of prestige and a lot of history that goes with it.
Yeah, and Rolex was a huge sponsor this year, and the payout was not bad. Kyle Wyman, with his winnings, took out a purse of $25,000. Sean Kelly in second, $20,000. Bobby Fong, $15,000. So, hey, if you were on top of the box, man, you got to take home some nice cash. Not bad for a weekend.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a big payday for those guys. You know, especially a privateer like Wyman, that's going to go a long, long way.
Exactly. That'll help his, at least the first couple rounds of Moto America, and definitely he's got to do a lot of work probably getting those Ducatis up to speed and up to race snuff, I would say. And, you know, we have some limited rules, but as we've seen in the past, Moto America also does have some rules that allow quite a bit of spending still. So hopefully that does get Kyle up towards the sharp end of the pack. It'd be good to see him up there, especially with the Ducati. Now, enough of that. Let's get on to World Superbike. And then Super Pole.
All right, so with Super Pole, we had a bit of a non-surprise. We got three really long straights in Thailand, and the Ducati just let its legs go, you know? Bautista, again, topped the timesheets.
Fair warning, everybody. I predict me and Derek are going to be beating a dead horse today about Ducati all the way through until we finish this show.
I don't have a problem with that.
Of course you don't. What kind of bike do you own again?
A Ducati.
Oh, right. So, okay.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, got those red bikes, man. Actually, none of my Ducatis are red. Fun fact. Anyway, back to the actual red and fast Ducatis of Alvaro Bautista. Actually, it's really only his that's red and fast. All the other Ducatis, again, had a difficult weekend, but Bautista is making that bike work, and then, you know, familiar Ray behind. But what was surprising is that he was almost a half second behind. Mm-hmm. And that Kawasaki looked so much better on the infield section than the Ducatis.
It looked better in everything but the straightaway. The brakes, it looked better. The turns, it looked better. Straightaway, mm-mm.
Yeah, so the fact that Ray had lost almost a half a second, essentially just in the straights, is pretty demoralizing. Mm-hmm. And then you think of the next couple tracks they go to, Aragon has that back straight. But I feel like Aragon, those first couple sectors are even tighter and twistier. So I don't know, it could work out. But half second, and then we had Alex Lowe's in third, and it's just been a Yamaha battle. Again, another theme. You had Alex Lowe's in third, Cortese up in fourth, Leon Haslam in the second seat in the Kawasaki was in fifth, and he hasn't been to Thailand for a while, has he?
No, I don't believe so. I don't know if he's actually ever been to Thailand, because they jumped into Thailand, 3 years ago now? I'm not sure if he was still in World Superbike, or did he have moved all the way over to BSP by then?
I think he was still in World Superbike, right? Because they started going in 2015, and Haslam's been in BSP for the last 3 years.
Oof, man, when it comes to timetables, it's all blur at this point. Where is Harry when you need him?
We are no BSB experts here, but I think he had a couple of years in Thailand, but still, you know, again, a new bike, a track that he hasn't been to in a long time, fifth place, solid effort. And then what was really surprising here, Sykes in sixth. Mm-hmm. We have those three really long straights. They're basically running a stock engine, and he still finished less than a second behind Bautista for qualifying. Obviously, that bike is working really, really well in the corners, really, really well in tight, twisty stuff, to only be a second behind Bautista and basically less than a half a second behind Ray. That's going to be interesting when that BMW gets a real engine.
Right, when they get a little more power on the top end, because oddly enough, the one bike that we thought was going to have the top end seems to have just about the least amount.
In the Kawasaki?
No, the BMW. Prior to them leaving World Superbike, they were a rocket ship, and their braking and corner entry was kind of like the Achilles heel of it before. They seem to have fixed that issue, but lost their power, or they just kept the power from before and everyone just caught up, went past them, so they got to put a little more work into that. You know what's been surprising, it's still the same thing, was, you know, Laverty finished in front of Davies, but Davies still not looking right on that new Ducati, especially with his teammate doing what he's doing out in front.
It has to come down. Obviously, they're two different riders. They ride in two different ways. Bautista's coming from GP, he's coming from the V4. Davies coming from the twin. So that's one difference. But then their actual physical height. Bautista's a small dude. I 1 year when I went to Indianapolis for the GP, went down to that bike night they had in the Capitol. I ran into him, and he was just in street clothes, and no one like really realized who he was. And I was like, oh man, let me get a picture with you. So I have a picture with him, and he must be like 5'3", 5'4", tops. Mm. And Chaz is probably closer to 6 foot, yep. Right? So you have, you know, 6-7 inch difference. They must weigh 30-40 pounds different. Just the actual size of the people allow Bautista to really utilize that power going in and out of corners.
Absolutely.
And so I think that's a big part of it. Not that Chaz can't use the top speed, because I'm sure if you look at the speed trap times, Chaz is up there, but it's not being utilized the way Bautista can utilize it. So I think there's a lot of things going on there, and obviously with that, though he has access to Bautista's data, I'm sure it's worthless just because they're so different from a physical standpoint.
Right, the setup is completely, I mean, outside of what they prefer, if a loose bike or if a tight bike, I mean, the spring ratios are absolutely completely different. The preload and rebound, all that is absolutely really different. I mean, tire pressures, everything. There's nothing that can be carried over outside of red paint.
Yeah, so and I'm sure he experienced that with Melandri last year, because Melandri's, again, just like five feet tall.
Right.
So it's obviously not something that he has to adjust to, not being able to use someone else's data, but he's just coming from a totally different bike. And then, yeah, like you said, like with suspension, preload, rebound, all those settings, he doesn't even have that information from the other bikes, because everyone else is running different suspension. So someone like Laverty, which probably be closer to him, is still like he's using totally different stuff.
Right, because I think Rinaldi's on the Showa. Is Laverty on the Showa as well?
No, he's on a brand called Bitubo. Oh. I think they're an Italian brand. I actually have a set of their rear shocks on one of my Ducatis. Mm. Fun fact. But yeah, I think they've done a bunch of World Supersport teams. They're a relatively small brand, but no Olin's, no Showa, no big suspension company. They seem pretty small.
Nice.
But not a lot of data to go off of.
Gotcha. All right, so we get to the race one, and Alvaro Bautista wins the race by 8 seconds, but it didn't necessarily look like that in the beginning because him and Johnny Ray had that nice collision just a few laps in. Well, I say nice collision. There was a bit of a rub. Johnny Ray took a different line than Alvaro Bautista did into turn three, and it was one of those where lines intersect. You can't really help it. No one's at fault. They come together. Bautista almost drops the bike, keeps it going, and dropped back. I would say he's maybe like 2 seconds behind Ray, and then he kind of got away from, I think Lowe's was right there hassling him for about three corners, got away from him, put his head down, and then caught Ray right up. They had a little bit of a couple ding-dongs through the next couple corners, and then Bautista was gone after that. And like you said, he continued to run. He was setting the lap record during the race, and he was from the previous year. He was breaking the lap record constantly from the previous year during the race, and he was running something like 0.4, 0.5 seconds a lap faster. So every two laps, he was putting another second into that field. It was quite impressive.
It was very impressive, and just going back to the clash, if you will, the contact. Yeah, if you watch the race, if you watch all three races, it's Ray and Bautista taking totally different lines to that corner, but they consistently take the same lines that they did, and it just so happened that they got to the same point on the track and wanted the same bit of asphalt. So they touched. It was dramatic. It was reminiscent of like Assen last year in MotoGP, where Marquez almost comes off the bike, and you're just like, how did he stay on that? It was the same thing. I don't know how Bautista stayed on, but thankfully he did, and kind of ran away with that. That was the most impressive part, because he lost a lot of time and was just able to take off again. Yep. So, but again, kind of you watch it, you see how much later Ray can break and, kind of carry that, as opposed to Bautista, who I think he said he was struggling with brakes during race one. I don't know if it was because of the heat or what, but
Thailand ends up causing that quite a bit, because it is so hot there that the, struggling with brakes, like Marco Melandri was struggling with brakes in the second race as well. It happens to a lot of the riders out there, because it's just so much hotter, and you get the hot air blowing over what's already hot rotors. It's not doing a whole lot to cool it down, or as fast as it would normally, getting some nice cool air over that, and brake fade, especially with those humongous straightaways and having to clamp on as hard as they do. And they do a couple of those they actually do all the straightaways back to back to back, because they come down, what is it, the back?
Yeah, it's like the last corner, the first corner, and then turn three. So it's like they it's all like a U that they do, basically, back to back to back.
And I can imagine the kind of heat they're putting in the brakes by the time they're getting to turn three. It's probably why most incidents or people running off the track is right there. Dude, Laverty, holy crap, did you see what happened to him? So he crashed, but he had no brakes coming down that. Speaking of straightaways, he goes down into the final corner, and during the shot, all you saw was like a bike go flying past the screen. And I think Steve English and the other guy, they were sitting there like, oh, somebody crashed that background. You back it up.
Yeah, he was like, oh, it's the front end. And I'm like, no way that's the front end, because that bike was still upright and just like barreling into the wall.
It was a blur when it went by on the screen. Just choop. Like, what the hell was that? Like, all you know is somebody went off. And, man, Laverty had to do going in the corner, no brakes, 200 kilometers an hour, and jumped off the thing.
The ejector seat.
That is scary.
Got to press the ejector seat
button. I saw his Instagram photo where he took a picture of his leathers, and, well, if there's ever any selling point for leathers or how good they can protect a rider, that was it, because he didn't have a scuff on him. He walked away, but getting off at 200 kilometers an hour and sliding across the pavement and barely into the gravel... Yikes, man. That is not something you want to do. And he's had four of those now, he said, where he's gone into a corner and not had brakes. That is absolutely scary.
That'd be terrifying. I can't even imagine. That 130 miles an hour. Oh my God.
Yeah. And just to jump off on the pavement too. Not like, oh, look, some grass or maybe this might. No, straight to the ground. There's a wall approaching really quick. I got to go and hope nobody behind me runs my ass over.
Those airbag suits, they're a thing of magic. Yes.
Absolutely amazing. We had talked about in qualifying, Chaz Davies still not looking himself. He did have a couple nice passes, but then ended up crashing in turn three with 12 to go. And man, the way he was looking at the bike, he's already having a rough season. He already looks mentally defeated, and it just, man, I feel bad for the guy.
He definitely doesn't look like himself. And in Phillip Island, you know, he's had a preseason of injuries. And at Phillip Island, I definitely don't think he was 100%. No. I think he's probably feeling better with a 3-week break, but it's possible he's still not at 100% and he's just not saying anything about it. That, and in addition to trying to learn a new bike and make changes for, you know, if he's not 100%. So yeah, there's a lot going on there, but didn't Chaz crash there last year? Same spot. Just tuck the front.
It sounds right.
Turn three.
It sounds right. Because that was the problem with last year's bike, is that it was limited on top end. So he had to really, really push it on the brakes and ended up washing out the front end. That happened to Aragon too, coming down the back straight away and ate it when he was, I think he was leading the race right there in front of Ray. Yeah, that might be something that has to do with not only, obviously, his riding style. He has to get on the brakes and he's pushing. But start to wonder about that, the weight thing and the way that the Ducati is set up, if it's, you know, if that's what's hampering, maybe the front end doesn't feel very good and he doesn't have a lot of confidence on it yet.
Exactly. Exactly. So, yeah. So that was pretty much race one. I felt like race one was the most kind of exciting of the World Superbike races this time around. The Super Pole race was, as we will get to now, was, again, pretty exciting for the first couple laps, but it was the kind of the same thing as Phillip Island. After those first, you know, half the race distance, five laps, Bautista just kind of took off again.
Yeah, he got out the early start, and then really the race that you wanted to watch is Melandri and Haslam. They had a good battle in the first race, and they basically picked up right where they left off in the second race. They had a nice battle going in this one here.
You know, Melandri was looking really strong, and actually, Chaz was looking much better in this race, and then Melandri kind of made a super aggressive move.
Yeah.
And he tried to make that move a couple times on Haslam as well, and kind of sent Davies back, and that's kind of where he finished in eighth place, I think.
Right.
Kind of just behind the rest of the Yamahas and the Kawasaki. So, yeah, Chaz was looking a little bit better, but Melandri was looking really strong, again, in that, like, infield tight, twisty, what is it, sector three, where it gets really twisty. Mm-hmm. He was just looking really confident in the corners with that bike.
So this is the race. Obviously, this was short flat. It was shortened. The FA came out with four to go with the crash that we had talked about earlier involving Wirakon, Kamir, and... who was the other bike there? He tapped going in. Already escaped my mind already.
Mercado?
Mercado. Thank you. Going back there. And so shortened it up. They called it early, which makes sense. You're not going to go out there and do a four-lap sprint on a 12-lap, 10-lap race. Doesn't make any sense. I did want to mention the points. I don't think I mentioned it last time. The payout is around about half. So first place is 12, second place 9, and third place 7, so on and so forth. But as we can see so far, Bautista has 100% batting right now. He's gotten all the races. And it was exact repeat of the first race, too. So it was Bautista, Ray, and Lowe's. So at this point, after this race, I kind of wanted to do some digging, like get a little more informed about how the rev limit are. Because you can physically see, especially in this race, Bautista just pulled. He didn't even draft Ray on one of the straights. He just pulled out and drove completely around him and then pulled in. It's like, all right, there's a pretty big jumping. So there was a big discussion I found on Twitter involving David Emmett, and he was kind of answering some questions, and Steve English actually jumped in, because David Emmett's like, hey, the Kawasaki is kind of a new bike too, it's not rev limit. And Steve English was quick to correct that. He's like, no, there is a rev limit. They measure the rev limit. It has to do now. I'm not getting this technically sound, so take it how you will, but they do the rev limit in between the third and fourth gear and match it up. So the Kawasaki ended up getting something like a penalty of 600 RPM or something like that on top of what they've already had from the previous year, or they gained back 600. The 600 was in there. They either gained back 600 or they lost 600 more. And so they're currently rev, whereas the Ducati, they haven't been able to put a rev limit on it because they don't know where that bike sits.
But that's interesting, though, because doesn't Kawasaki technically have a newly homologated bike?
That's what they said, but Steve English, I should probably find it on Twitter, and maybe I'll edit back in the show and get a little bit more into detail about it.
Hey folks, it's Skyler from the Future of Editing. Want to just kind of clear up my thoughts there. It was a bit muddy. So I was referring to what Steve English had put on Twitter. The calculation is done on the average of the max revs for engines in third and fourth gear. Kawasaki has a new bike with 600 more revs, but their new rev limit isn't the same increase. He also compared this to like the BMW's all new but actually revs less this year compared to last. So that is what I was reading there. So still has a rev limit, did not get increased even though Kawasaki's motor increased. So let's see where it goes from here. All right, back to the show as normally planned.
At this point, I'm fine with them keeping the rev limit, but you need to go ahead and correct. If you're putting a penalty on them and they're getting pulled in the straights, then you have to put it on the Ducati.
Yeah, well, I think the weird part to me is that if their reasoning for not putting one on the Ducati is that it's a new bike, then technically the new ZX10RR is a new bike. It was, you know, there's new like titanium bits in the engine. So technically it's a new bike. Like why
I would assume, you know, because it changed format. You went from a twin to a four cylinder, they wouldn't be able to compare them directly. I would also assume this was a decision made by people that are much smarter and knowledgeable than me, as we can tell that I've found a little bit of information and tried to expand on it. And when someone asks me a question, I'm like, I don't know, man. It is what it is.
No, so, I know. It's just interesting. I don't know. I guess it's just like kind of politics and rulemaking, and which can be very frustrating. But it doesn't seem like there's a lot of frustration by the teams, at least outwardly. I don't know what's going on inside the boxes, but...
Yet. I think the key word is yet. It's two races in.
It's true.
They may give the series the benefit of the doubt, let the series balance itself out, because if they do penalize the Ducati and then everybody, you know, they uncork maybe the Yamaha a little bit more if they have any penalties against them. They're pretty close, but, you know, give them a little extra, you know, 500 RPM and you keep the Cowies right where they're at and do something for... the BMWs, I don't know, take 40 pounds off the back of that thing. I don't know. But get them all nice and close, you will see it. Because one thing, it is disheartening to see, and you know it happens in every sport, but you see it more and more as people are saying, Bautista came in here and he's completely ruined Ray's legacy. And that's just not the case. It really isn't. Ray's like, dude, let's not, and this is where it gets tough with the new rules. This is what we were worried about, right? Because if you start penalizing the motorcycles, and you start, we're going to be three races in, and let's not act like Bautista's not going to clean it up at Aragon. With that big ass straightaway and that power of that thing, right now he's got a good chance of going here. Put all your money on him, right? I mean, everything can happen. We don't know. But if he gets out and goes 6 for 6, or actually, what is it, 9 for 9 at that point, how big is that points lead before they do anything? It might be insurmountable, because even when they do penalize the Ducati, Bautista is still going to win races. So it's going
to
be tough.
I mean, by that time, if it comes down to the rev limiters, like I'm just looking at the calendar now, like there's some tighter tracks like Jerez, and then we're going back to Laguna, and you know, like tracks that the actual top end won't matter, that Bautista can still do well at. Yeah, because right now he has like a 20. I think it's a 26-point advantage, because shocker, he wins the third race of this weekend, as we haven't got to, but I'm sure you know if you're listening to this. Yeah, copy paste from race one.
Leon, I will say that Laverty didn't make any of the following races, though. I don't think they could get the bike together in time. He couldn't make the Super Bowl race, and he didn't make race two either. The bike was just too tore up, and they are a bit of a smaller team. They did get some assistance from the factory of getting some parts on there, but it was too much damage, I believe.
Yeah, you can't imagine there's a lot of parts going around for that bike in the first place, and then whatever extra parts they had in Thailand of all places, I don't think the factory was able to really help them out there. So Which is a shame because I want to see Ducatis out there. I want to see Laverty out there, just because it's a totally different package. So, bit of a shame. But yeah, those race two kind of copy paste Bautista, Ray, Lowe's, Vandermark, and Haslam were your top.
Haslam
five.
And Landry once again finding each other on track. This may be a battle that can turn to a nice rivalry for the rest of the year that I can definitely get on with because neither one of those guys are very shy about putting up the inside of one another there.
Yeah, there's one point that Haslam did his leg dangle and Melandri just like went right. He had to like put his leg in so quick. It was. I think we're gonna see more of those.
I don't think we can call that a leg dangle. That's a kung fu kick at this point, isn't it?
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair.
Kamir, same thing. But Kamir's a lot taller, dude. I mean, they go to the corner and that leg was perpendicular to the motorcycle. It wasn't just hanging off anymore. It's just like, whoo, it hangs off the bike. I'm like, dude, they may start to crack down on that a little bit because it's starting to be don't pass me on the inside. I'll put my leg out here in front of you kind of thing. And that may lead to someone getting their leg sucked into a front tire eventually. But we'll see how that plays out. But I just thought it was funny because, man, those guys are throwing legs out there. I did want to talk about Melandri being one of the smaller guys. It does hamper him in the fact that just like the Ducati, this guy gets on a straightaway and that bike's wobble is insane. And what's really, really scary about that wobble that he gets at a high speed, other than the fact he's shaking side to side at 190 miles an hour, is that when you do that, of course, you know, your brake pads can end up slapping back and you can go into a corner after doing 190 miles an hour and grab the front brake and wind up like Laverty. I mean, just like, oh, shit. So,
yeah,
I'm sure he's aware of that and can give a couple pumps before heading into the corner. But, man, that's sketchy.
Yeah. Well, obviously, they found a fix with that with mm-hmm. Ducati. So, hopefully, they can apply that same logic. Is that a steering damper thing? Is that a weight distribution?
He mentioned that Ducati added a part to the motorcycle, which fixed it last time. So, whatever it is, they may be able to correct it quite quickly. He may have wanted to not have that same part, whatever it is. I personally think they just turned that freaking steering damper up to 11 and say, well, good luck.
I don't know. They got to do something because that's terrifying. Incredibly spectacular to watch, but terrifying.
So I have a question for you. We're going to move on to World Supersport. Lucas Mias, why did he go to the Kawasaki? Did he lose his ride or he just thought, I'm going to go to the Kawasaki now because I like being behind a bunch of R6s at this point.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that's tough. Obviously, because he's on Pedicini, right? The Keenan Sofoglu's old team. Is that Pedicini? Yeah, so obviously it's a good outfit. It's a good team. They're a professional team. But at this point, the R6 is really the only bike that's being developed. Especially him winning on the R6 just a few years ago. To now go to the Kawasaki, and I'm sure he's seen the Kawasaki, and the updates that it had it got like new bodywork last year. Like that's it. So I don't know why he went to the Kawasaki. That's a fantastic question.
You know, money talks, and a seat opens up. You gotta go where you gotta go. Maybe the other team he was with wasn't doing. I haven't stayed on top of it enough to really know. I'm just giving him shit. Really, he did have to start from the back of this race, which. Anybody, no matter who you put back there, is going to hamper them. It was kind of cool, though, because he's got that big old pink helmet that he wears, so he's easy to spot. And I swear, he started the race in the back and went to turn three. He was like 10th already. I was like, oh, shit. He made up all those spaces already? Like, all right, not too bad of a start. Wasn't as good as Cluzel, though.
It's the first two races of the season. He's been on it. He's ready to take this title. And it's nice to see that, you know, he's going to be on a reliable bike. So it's not, I just remember the couple of years he was with MV. He looked so good on that bike. And then it just like blew up on him so many times. It was the same thing with PJ on that bike. He looked good on it and it broke down. And especially in Thailand when it was so hot, I think like every year the MV ended up blowing up.
Well, the other problem with the PJ, because, you know, he went out there and he could qualify really, really well. And this dives back into something me and Jim were talking about with Maverick Vinales, is that they got to take big old swooping lines because that bike was 100% corner speed. And as soon as you would get into a race, everyone's dives up the inside, he can't ride his line. And that's what led to PJ not getting a lot of wins on that. And I mean, the bike is good in a corner, but man, it suffered on the brakes and corner entry for sure.
Yeah. So anyway, it was great to see Jules up there. Once he got out front, he just put his head down, really.
And speaking of Vinales, there's his cousin, Isaac Vinales, is now in World Supersport. And I kind of forgot about that, but he was making himself known. He got out there and was duking it out, led the race a little bit, and was giving the front runners all the... I mean, he was mixing it up with Garrett Casulo. He was mixing it up with Cluzel. Not really expected. He looked good, man. He wasn't there on like, oh, this is a one-off race. They must have got something right or it's horsepower. But he looked good. I think he can build upon this confidence that he's going to be someone that they need to worry about for the rest of the year.
I hope so, yeah, because he looked good. His elbows were out. He was ready to race. But I was also a little concerned because in Moto2, we kind of got that reputation for putting it down the road a little too often.
He didn't get the Manzi reputation, but that's close.
that's another level. Talk
about
an MV.
Still there too.
Oh. I know. Whatever. Cluzel was out front. He had a little bit of a tussle with some guys in the first couple laps, but you know he started to break away, and his just consistency of his lap times that was the key. But then you had Krumenacher made a really not good start. He got pushed wide in the first corner. And I thought that was going to be it for him just because the pace of Cluzel and Caracasulo had just been so good, especially Caracasulo, teammates. I thought that if there was going to be a fight, it wasn't going to end well. But Krumenacher really just, he sat behind a couple of riders for a number of laps, I think Akubo. Was he also fighting with Mayas? There's a Kubo and then a couple of the Yamahas in front, I guess.
Yeah, because who was the gap back? Because they had, it was up front, there was, for a while, it was Cluzel, Vinales, and Caracasulo, right? They were kind of, Kubo was there for a little bit, then he trailed off, and they kind of had the riders behind.
It was DeRosa and Barbara. That's
right, Barbara. Right? And then, Gradinger, he was up there. He was the fourth bike in the first four.
Oh, yeah.
And then he blew his engine up, which, I was hoping he didn't, because he was all over the racing line, but didn't put too much oil. But I felt so bad for that kid, man. He was having a hell of a race. And it looked like he was just waiting. Like, he was sitting there. He had made any moves, but he wasn't getting dropped. And so he might have had something to show towards the end, and then poof, went the engine.
Yeah, but Krumenacher was just kind of behind them for a while. He wasn't really making any progress. So I thought that was kind of going to be it, unfortunately. But
dude, how in the hell did he bridge that gap?
I don't know. He just like started to pick them off one by one, and eventually he was up there. And I feel like he does not like his teammate. I don't know if that's the vibe that I'm getting from all the like interviews and pit lane and stuff. I don't think he likes his teammate. And so anytime I see those two bikes together, I'm just afraid that it's going to end very poorly, because those are obviously probably the two fastest guys out there. I think Cluzel obviously is up there this year as well. But that's when it got exciting for me to see those two start to go at it.
You know, they did Cluzel a huge favor when Krumenacher and Caracasulo really got into it. Cluzel all of a sudden had like instant 3-second lead.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, all right, cool. Thanks, guys. I don't have to work hard for this anymore. You guys go ahead and beat the crap out of each other. And they kind of brought, I think Akubo was starting to make his way back towards them. And I was like, oh, these guys are going to, yeah, you're right. They definitely don't look like they like each other. Krumenacher, you know, he's been always a good one to throw it in and battle it hard. But Caracasulo is not a fit anybody. And he's run hot. And he's gotten a lot better since a couple years ago when he was just kind of finding his way in a World Supersport.
Mm-hmm.
Like you said, he's definitely on his day probably the fastest rider out there.
For sure.
But given that, and he's proven it this year so far, we got to get the consistency out of him, because he kind of has a slump from time to time where he'll go out there and drop it in like 3 or 4 races or do something kind of boneheaded. But you know one thing about all those guys, you know what they have in common? R6s.
Yep.
Out of the top 8, like 6 of them were R6s. I'm like, oh, man, this is going to turn to an R6 cut pretty soon. And I don't know how I feel about that.
It's definitely unfortunate. But I think that's just kind of the way. I wonder if 600 inline fours are going to be what we're still doing in like 5 years time.
You know what I predict? We had forever the Yamaha, or not the Yamaha, the Ninja 250, right? Forever. That was the only small displacement bike that we had here mm-hmm. in America that was made. And then what they do, they went to a 300, so they had the 250 and a 300. And then everyone's like, oh, cool, we want to make a small bike and get some of that money. So everybody made a 300. Honda's like, hey, we got a 400. It's like, okay. And then Honda's like, we also have a 500. Okay, so we're not making 600s anymore. We're going to get rid of that class, and we're going to replace them with 600s. What? it's just full circle, yeah. You know?
I think either we're going to go down in displacement, so we're going to have, like, a 250 and then a 400 and then make the big jump. But what I really think is going to happen is we're going to go to, like, twins, and we're going to do the, like, 700 twins, right? So we have, like, KTM has their Duke that they came out with. You have Aprilia that teased that that like 600, almost 700 twin at EICMA last year. And then you have these other bikes that you can, you know, basically make into basically like 600 to 700 cc twin race bikes, right? Mm-hmm. So I wonder if that's what we're moving towards, like a more production. Obviously, these are production bikes, but more like you take a, I guess more like what they're doing in the was it Super Twins at the Isle of Man and on the roads. Maybe more like that, but with more performance bikes, because obviously the 600s, just the market is just dwindling for full on street race bike. But I don't know. I have no fucking idea if that's going to happen.
Yeah, you know, that brings up an interesting thing. I want to move away from the race because I think we've got that covered. Clozel, obviously, with the win. Krumenacker, Caracasulo, Vinales, De Rosa. But what you said there, right, with what's going on with sport bikes. You know, you brought up something that I did want to talk about more and maybe outside of racing in the future of motorcycles in general was that, you know, what are they going to be doing next? Me and my buddy were sitting at a bar not so long ago. We were talking about like what's going on with the super sport class, or just like Moto America in general. Why can't we get numbers up? Even though if they're doing a really good job, it doesn't seem like there's a lot of people getting motorcycles back up. I don't know where you live if this is the case, but where I'm at, there's been a huge drop off in people that not only ride their motorcycles but own motorcycles. I don't think there's a huge. I remember, probably when I was about 17, 18. There was motorcycles everywhere. You go down the freeway, you see motorcycles all day long. You would see huge groups of people riding together. And that is just not the case anymore. It almost seems like it was a fad for about 20 years where people were really getting after bikes. And as soon as we hit that first recession, the motorcycle industry never really recovered back from that when it came to new motorcycle sales.
Yeah, I think that's the main thing is the recession. And especially how those bikes were being paid for. And then in addition with the crash. So yeah, I you know, I'm not all that old, but I definitely feel that that just new motorcycle sales and motorcycles in general, and me kind of working in the motorcycle industry for the past 4 years, you know, I definitely see that a lot of it was baby boomers, and that there a lot of them are aging out. And you see all these manufacturers, you know, kind of making new bikes, and then they're going for the electric bike. And you see a lot like Honda and MV Agusta, KTM, Husqvarna, they're coming out with like automatics, so that, you know, it's a little bit more digestible for millennials and or just younger people. I really hate the word millennial. I'm so over it. I'm just going to say younger folks.
Young adults,
just to get young adults to get them on motorcycles and to see that it's a valid form of transportation. And I think that's really difficult in this day and age. But that's the challenge now for these manufacturers. So you go back to like the golden age of super bikes in America, and you know, those bikes were flying off the showrooms, and that's not the case anymore. One, because of the financial like area we're in nowadays, and two, because people see motorcycles as like a toy and not a motor transportation.
Well, the other thing too is the cost, right? And this is part of the reason why the 600 are going out. If you go down to a showroom floor, you put a R1 and R6 next to each other. First of all, the R1 is not even that much bigger now. It's ridiculous how small liter bikes are. But the cost isn't that much different. What is an R6 now? It's like 12 freaking grand, and an R1 is what, 14, 15? It's like, of course you're going to buy a superbike. And they were saying it takes just as much to develop a superbike or a 600 as it does a superbike. Well, moneymaker is going to be the superbike, so we don't want to make that anymore. And plus, I think a lot of the manufacturers, especially in the Asian manufacturers, are shifting their focus more to countries like that are have a recent middle class is now coming up of age, right? India, China, Indonesia, a lot of the countries right there in the, what do you call that area there? Just, you know, west of Japan in the sea there where Indonesia, Malaysia, all that is right there. Southeast Asia.
The South Pacific.
There we go.
Yeah.
Where small bikes and scooters are huge. And then, you know, we've seen obviously with the addition of the Thai Round and moving, you know, even GP getting there, that it's booming. Motorcycle racing is booming there, but it's small bikes is booming there. So the market, people here, I mean, first it was nobody was buying sport bikes here. Like that was gone. And nobody's really racing. Club racing is taking a huge hit. If you think Motor America is taking a hit, club racing is even worse, so affected.
Well, yeah, and it ultimately just comes down to the costs. Like, you know, you think, you know, $300-$400 for a pair of tires for a weekend if you're on a superbike. Like when I'm at the track, I'm on a 250 because I can spend all season on one pair of tires. It's fantastic. It's great. I love it.
That when it comes to the cost, especially with racing, and why BSB can just kill Moto America. BSB is, I mean, Great Britain is what, the size of California? And then they have how many racetracks? And the teams can go up and down and get to everything relatively within probably, I would say reasonably, 8 to 10 hours. If I am completely wrong, please write us in. But it's got to be fairly close. You've got teams based in California, teams based in Florida, teams based in Texas, whatever. These guys are 4 to 5 days just from each other. And let alone if you're a California-based team and there's a race in New Jersey, dude, you're talking in a semi-truck with your team stuff, you're talking a week to get your stuff out there. And the cost of diesel and freight and toll roads, and I can't imagine what a transportation costs just to get one race weekend in where you don't even make that much money doing it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think a great example of that is Josh Herron the other year when his bike didn't show up. It's like he literally could not get his bike there. Like there was no other way to get it there, just because it was so far away. But yeah, and add the costs onto that. All these, especially for the factory teams, you know, they got the trailers on trailers that they're trying to haul to all these places. And then you look at England and you can just, I can't like the amount of racetracks in that small of an area. It's like, you know, I drive 3.5 hours to like get to the closest racetrack, you know. And I'm sure for a 3.5 hour drive in England, I'm sure you can get to a bunch of racetracks. Right. So,
and that's on the good side here, mind you. I mean, I'm in a wealth of embarrassment riches because I've got Sonoma, you know, an hour north of me. Oof. Laguna is an hour or about an hour south of me, and Thunder Hill is about 2.5 hours from me. But then if I wanted to go to another track, it's either Oregon or LA. Now we're looking at 6 to 8 hours. So you're...
How far does Len have to go to go to Aragon?
Yeah, I don't know, because that is it.
Got a world-class GP track. He's just kind of, that's his right, home base.
I think there's one that's actually closer to him, too. I think there's another track. It's the one, doesn't Tito Rabat always go and throw himself around for like 100 laps a day or something, I think? I think that one might be closer to him. I'm not sure.
In Almeria?
Is it Almeria?
I was thinking of the one that he posted about, or he emailed us about the other week. Where it was his, he has a new track in his backyard.
He was having a little bit of fun. a freshly paved road in the alleyway driveway. There.
Yeah.
So, all right, but it will be interesting, like you said, to see what's going to happen. Will the electric bike scene kick up a whole new racing feature? Moto America is doing a great job, but I wouldn't be totally honest if I said I wasn't worried about racing here.
That's actually a bit of news. If you want to kind of backtrack to that e-bike.
Backtrack all you want.
the Moto E.
Oh yeah, we totally missed that.
Yeah, we totally missed that. I remember I woke up and like just looked at Twitter and there was a barrage of news. The Moto E test had to get canceled because the entire paddock that they set up in Jerez went up in flames due to a faulty generator, it seems like, which is nuts, which sucks because I'm again, I'm super excited about the Moto E class. I think that's great that Dorna has had the foresight to get into that. And it's not going to be some random other championship that some.
Yeah, it's on the big stage.
They're doing that right. It's on the big stage. It's a World Cup. It's not a World Championship thing. They're not trying to make it like the Isle of Man where it counts as a race win or something. They're just doing it to develop the technology and to showcase the technology. And, you know, one day the bikes are going to be good and fast and interesting. Yep. Right now it's a little bit more of an exhibition. It's still a race. It's still interesting. But it's there to develop the technology. And I think I'm super excited about that.
It will get faster.
Not super excited about the sound. Uh-huh. But I'm looking forward to it, and it sucks that it took such a big hit. I think they had to move the first race. The first race was supposed to be in.
They may have to move the second race too.
That was a bummer.
But like you said, the development eventually they're going to get fast. If you want to, you know, go look at Formula E. I think they're on their fourth or fifth year, and the first cars were like, okay, cool. Like, this is, they had to go out and change it halfway through the race. They had to get in the second car because the battery couldn't last the whole race. And now their cars are quick. They don't have, the batteries last a whole race. They do about an hour. They do have to watch their charges. So a bit of strategy there. But they are fast, like, hurt you fast now. And it's going to continue to get better.
In 5 years.
And you got to remember how long cars have been around and how long we've been racing them and where we are now. Same thing with motorcycles. How long, right? You put 60 solid years of like performance racing, not, you know, hey, you know, just got a couple guys out. I mean, just not so long ago in the 80s, these guys were bringing, you know, Joe Average got a TZ and brought it out to the track and raced it, right? Against top flight in the world. So you give it with the technology, the way it grows, and that they really push it and put it on the big stage, it's going to get there quickly. And there's all kind of supercars now that'll outrun any petrol car. It's amazing how fast these things are getting and how quickly they're getting to that speed.
Again, definitely a big blow. Sounds like the championship's still going to go on this year, but that was definitely a bit of news that we missed there.
Well, glad we caught that. Let's cap off this here. We can definitely circle back. One thing I just want to make sure we went over the World Superbike Championship, since we do have two races in the books. Alvaro Bautista is leading the championship on 124 points. 26 back is Jonathan Race in there, 98. Alex Lowe's in third. Michael Vandermark in fourth. Marco Melandri in fifth. There's that Yamaha battle we were alluding to. Leon Haslam sitting there in sixth in front of Sandro Cortese. Michael Rubinaldi. Toprak Razak Galioglu, I think I almost got that right, in ninth. And then Tom Sykes in 10th. All right, Derek. So we've got more racing coming up. Like we said, it's on and off, on and off. We've got GP coming up here this weekend. So if you need your fix,
No, I think we got a week off.
Oh, you're right, because they're the 31st. I'm getting ahead of myself.
Yeah, man, we got to suffer a week with no racing.
Well, there's four wheel for those of us that also like the four wheel variety. There's plenty of that going on.
I did watch Formula One this past weekend. Mm-hmm. You'd be proud of me.
Yeah, all right, nice. Well, this watch the IndyCar race from COTA this weekend. That'll be a good one to watch.
There we go.
It's their first year there, so anything can happen. They've done a test there, but these guys like to bang fenders a lot more than F1. So if I was going to say you're going to put a little bit of... Since we have the weekend off, everybody wants to check it out. See, I'm just telling you, it's good. I mean, it's fun. I know people are into auto racing a lot of here, and a lot of these people are race heads all around, like myself, but IndyCar is where it's at this year.
Fun fact, quick side story. One year when I went to Indianapolis for the GP, I took a tour of the Dallara factory, who makes the chassis for IndyCar. That place is on another level. Like spotlessly clean. They showed us they couldn't show us a lot, but what they showed us, you know, you like look at all the little welds and how perfect everything is. It was amazing. So I had a new respect for IndyCar after that. No motorcycle racing this weekend. Some IndyCar racing from COTA. And yeah, we'll be back that following week because GP is going to be on the 31st, right?
Exactly. So we'll be back to talk it then. Remember, folks, you can reach us at the email at motopod@motopodcast.com. You can get us on Facebook. That's the Motopod fan page. That's facebook.com/motopod. We're also on Twitter at @moto_pod. Join us on any of those platforms. Shoot us a message. We'll get to you. We'll post a lot of things up too. Get some questions answered. So on and so forth. You know the deal. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at SkylarV28. Same thing on Instagram. Derek, where can people find you?
People can find me at MotoDerekC on Twitter and Instagram.
And remember, folks, if you want to get in contact with our other hosts, such as Andrew, he's at Andy_course. Jim is at MotoRGV on both Twitter and Instagram. All right, Derek, I know it's getting late for you. I'm getting hungry. I'm pretty sure my wife is out there pouting because she wants to eat and she's waiting for me. I don't know why she could eat without me, but that's a rule I guess we have that I need to get the hell on out of here and get to dinner.
All right, man. We'll see you next time.
All right. See you later, everyone. Zoom, zoom.